Okay, the other thing that comes to me, of course, is this organism and system, and this beautiful phrase from Minot, Jacques Minot, you all know, what's true for E. coli is true for the elephant, to which one of my professors, Bill Sistrom, who was postdoc with him, responded, so why aren't there any prokaryotic elephants? So this choice of systems and universality, and you're asking for microscopic mechanisms that give rise to macroscopic properties, all act interplay in that those two, that statement in question. And also, of course, the shared knowledge, the consensus knowledge, is much less in the discipline, so-called, of biology than it is in physics. Of course, over the last few days, I've become more aware of my ignorance in population biology, and realizing that, you know, sharing the odd beer with John Maynard Smith does not qualify one in the field. Right. And this again goes back to the issue of bridges even within biology and collaborations and so on, and what form they will develop. In this sense, I was quite interestingly distressed, because a number of people came to me and said they used to have physics at Rockefeller University, but now it's been killed. And I realized that, of course, we counted last week 15 explicit collaborations between physicists and biologists at Rockefeller University. It's very alive. And if you want to play that game, you can learn from us, or at least consider it. What? Yeah, it's called Center for Physics and Biology. But what does it mean? You have nice, smart people. It's been hard work, actually. Really hard work, talking to each other and building collaborations. Many, of course, have fallen to horrible pieces, I mean, at times. But anyway, this is a quote from one of my colleagues who's theoretical, well, actually experimental, high-energy physicist at Rockefeller. I'm sure we can all relate. All you theoreticians can relate. Everybody can relate. Well, yeah, right. But as you know, we in biology think it's done in a certain sense, right? That you have the basic evolutionary paradigm that's essentially iterative distillation with selection, and then you work out the implications of that, you know, they're very related. Say, what kind of, I don't know what, to the Schrodinger equation for the hydrogen atom or something, you know? So many of these population biology cases are working out the implication of this algorithm, which could be stated algebraically or this way. Most of what my sense from the population biologists from my reading of evolutionary literature is the emphasis is on the role of selection. And my particular interest is in the generation of the diversity, which is, I think, not treated in the same way, both theoretically and experimentally, in the majority of biology. But again, biology has a lot of sub-disciplines and clubs. And so here's another quote from Minot about the generation of diversity. This one didn't photocopy as well, so maybe I'll read it. It says, in modern biological research, in particular, the different types of discrete accidental alterations a DNA sequence may suffer, maybe substitution, that's what people call point mutation, deletion or additions, and various types of scrambling. We call these events accidental. We say they are random occurrences, and since they constitute the only possible source of modifications in the genetic text itself, the sole repository of the organism's hereditary structures, necessarily follows chance alone is the source of every innovation of all creation in the biosphere. Pure chance, absolutely free and blind, the root, and so on. And he goes on to say there's no concept in any of the sciences more destructive of anthropocentrism than this one, and so rouses. And this is clearly something one should, you know, it's very interesting. It's wrong in many interesting ways. Okay. But it makes a very interesting straw person. It's a very articulate and beautiful statement. I mean, and I think, you know, there's a lot of social ideological context for it, and for the way that biology, of course, because about human, you know, involves the context of the religious right, the context of Marxists, the context of Lamarckism. All of this stuff is going on, and it's behind why he would say it that way.
That book has very interesting history. On the cover, it says, instead of natural philosophy, it says national philosophy.
No. That's right. That's right. That's right. So he was very mixed up in the existentialist movement. There's a lot of political, national, philosophical context. Nonetheless, it's a statement of a position that's a very good straw person to discuss. Why it is that biology doesn't. Why it is that it's not a... What's wrong with it? It's a good place to start for dissection. Indeed, I thought the purpose of this program was that physicists understanding biology would import biologists to dissect. And that's the kind of, and that's kind of was my first apprehension of them. Anyway, I have, so this is what I would consider is a more realistic view of evolution. So it's expanded from the previous one. And of course we have the organism, the environment, selection. But it has other facets that give the system possibility of feedback, sophistication, evolving the mechanisms by which the variation is generated, which is kind of the focus of my talk. So this is actually discussed in that reprint, Evolution of Genetic Intelligence, Science 94. That one is easy to get. I can make copies. It's on the web, no problem. Anyway, the point is that organisms actually generate diversity as a function of the genes of DNA repair, of the genes of recombination, and so on. It's not. The DNA double helix is not one of the palm trees over there, and Captain Fate is throwing darts at it. And when they hit, that generates a random change, and these then become the raw material for natural selection. That is not the case. And there's a lot of biology in the algorithmic nature for generating. Yeah, well, I'm going to at least wave my arms. Yeah. I mean, even if we have a stochastic generation, say radiation, chemical treatment, and so on, generating lesions in the DNA, 99.999% of those go back to the wild-type sequence, so they're repaired. And those that don't are, in fact, not acted on by the enzymes of repair, which themselves are encoded by genes, which are part of the genome, and so on. And this spectrum of repair is hardly random, you know, and is modulated by physiology and sequence context and all kinds of stuff. So yeah, I'm going to go through a lot of examples. Oh, right. What we call the phenotype, it's really kind of interesting because if you talk about a mutator, and I will talk about, say, strains that are mutator, it's not a phenotype like, you know, five fingers or hair or something like that, because you can only tell what kind of mutator you are, what kind of genetic variation you are generating by looking at your progeny. So it's a phenotype, but a funny kind of phenotype in that you can only tell it retroactively. It's a little, in the issue of fitness and all that, a little different.
It's hardly random. I mean,
oh, okay.
To believe that all this machinery makes the race position destroy sort of independence and create all sorts of coronation.
Right.
There's still an element of randomness.
Right, there's certainly an element of randomness, without a doubt. And in some sense, we would say that a random generation of variation is the most creative, because, you know, you're without bias about what can come next. And if you're going to be too fixed, then, you know, how will you deal with real novelty? How will you actually do anything creative? So I think there is indeed a trade-off between those, because from a mechanistic point of view, it's very easy to evolve enzymes that generate a very non-random subset. But of course, once you have, it's hard to make an algorithm that's completely random, right? So you have some sacrifice. The fact that we have opposable thumb, fingers, and so on means we're not, our evolution is limited. And the meta issue here is if you limit the kind of variation you're generating, you're also taking some blind alleys, or there will be ways in which you lose. And indeed, life is, has that problem. I agree. And here's a little bit more what I mean, is that kind of in between. We can talk about DNA sequence, the chemical process and the enzymes I've hinted. You can also talk about informational, algorithmic, and this relates to how would you model mathematically, computer-wise. And if this is what Minot would say, on one extreme, the kind of white noise, every possible variation generated with any frequency. And then this is a very defined spectrum. Then, of course, we have these other things we call, I believe, white noise or pink noise or blue noise, you know. So various kinds of bias in the generation of variation. And these could be biases introduced by the enzymology. Some of them come about through environmental perception and so on. And I'll discuss such cases, a few such cases, focusing especially on the one that I'm writing up now that isn't here.
Can I go back to that question about randomness? Because there are levels of randomness. And you just say all mutations are equally likely, as if it were 25% of each nucleotide, and you can quickly show that it's non-random.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that after you allow for it, it won't be random, except that you do the experiment, now you discover codon usage is affecting it, and so it's not quite that. You've got to take account of that. And there's a whole hierarchy of levels.
Yes.
And you're saying there's an irreducible
level
at which
Starting here, I'm saying that most of the evolution we've been talking about has focused on issues like codon usage, which are issues of the selection. Okay, that's one. And so I'm trying to separate that, or at least show that that is not the only level at which the, you know, so that level I would like to dispense with, more or less, or it's not the focus. Rather, I'm saying that the generation of the variation itself before selection is the non-random aspect I want to focus on. And furthermore, that generation of variation is really a function of enzymes encoded by the organism, as surely as eye color or any other phenotype, although it's a funny phenotype because you really only see it in the progeny. You don't see it in the individual, you know, in the same way you see other phenotypes. But in the sense of being encoded by enzymes, it's a phenotype.
How does this differ, say, from what Barry Hall is looking at?
Yeah, part of what I'll talk about is mechanisms that can give rise to these kind of effects. So molecular mechanisms that could be involved in such effects. I'm not going to go to the mats with Barry Hall here about, you know, one or another experiment that I critique, but I'll present my own. But certainly this idea of, something that has a pseudo-Lamarckian character, depending on how you look at it, you know, is interesting. And that goes back to the ideological issue that I think there's been kind of a lot of Iron Curtain fallout in biology that's prevented us from thinking straight. And now that the Cold War is over, we're kind of allowed to have these forbidden thoughts and to really look at how does an organism do it and what's going on. So we're freer in some way of the religious right and the Cold War.
Let me make a little comment about the human-dogging insect. Perhaps very important for physicists to realize that there's no clear definition today for phenotype and genotype. Because like individual digestion features, it's certainly phenotype. But these are enzyme molecules.
Well, fair.
And they are phenotype. And then one step further, you are in the genotype.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a little bit what I try to get at here, you know, is that in the first case, we would put all of this inside the organism, and so I'm trying to expand it and show that the generation of diversity really goes through these other things, like the organism's perception of the environment does influence the character of genetic DNA sequence variation that it generates. But again, this issue of phenotype, and particularly when I said that phenotypic variation, here what I'm putting on the one hand is the kind of phenotype which are the progeny, right? And that's what I was saying, that it's an odd phenotype because it's not something an individual actually has. And here, the kind of genes of DNA metabolism and that whose both expression and so on is altered in an individual organism, is that kind of phenotype, like the enzymes of digestion. So in here, what I, you know, didn't have is, this is the place kind of where reproduction occurs, where new individuals are generated. And these are the guys who I meant, their phenotypic variants. Here I meant the phenotypic variation within an individual that gives rise to genetic variants, maybe gives rise, whatever, to sperm that has a different distribution of crossovers.
Despite the lack of definition of genetic phenotype, instead of being all
in a particular context, we can be sure what we're talking about. But I think to some extent, I want to quote Leonard Cohen, who was talking about the relationship of theology and religious experience as equivalent to the relationship of lovemaking to pornography, which is to say that they're not unrelated. They're not unrelated, but the difference is in pornography, it's restful in the sense that at least you know what you're talking about, okay? So usually, when we're talking about genotype, we will say, okay, we mean the DNA sequence, but that's not everything. If we define, I mean, it's a regular question, like if you're taking graduate students and doing comprehensive exams, you say, what's a gene? And no matter what they do, you tie them into a knot and show them that it's wrong and inadequate definition. Right. That's fine. That's fine. Yes. Good. 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 Well, I'm saying we're closer. Like I said, it's restful to have a context. Within the context of looking at pornography, we know what we're talking about. Within the context of looking at love, we have a harder time, or spirituality versus logical theology. That's the point. That we restrict ourselves, knowing that we're not talking about the whole thing, but not ignoring the other dimensions, but being clear about which we can define more precisely without getting lost. That's what we're trying to do. Okay, now these are human beings who've helped me with and who are on these papers that you have. And yeah, I guess the only one on there you might know is Albert Liebschaber. Okay. Now we get into this idea of units of diversity and selection. And I'll emphasize more microbes and cancer for the first part I'm talking about, just because this is what I'm working on now. The point here is that usually we say the cell is the ultimate unit of selection in that sense. You can talk in a populational sense about inheritance of a gene or something apart from cell. But think about a group of cells, you're going to put some selection on them, who lives and who dies. And it's similarly in cancer. But there are exceptions to the cell as the lower limit in this context. Of course, Lin Chao, who I'm sorry I wasn't here for, of course, studies evolution of viruses within cells. So of course you have viruses evolving, competing, and so on, and all of that, and the cell is the environment in which they live. It's proposed, and there is interesting work going on, some of which I'm trying to participate in, but have no real result to share or anything. That mitochondrial DNA sequences and mitochondria within individual cells are also undergoing a lot of competition and evolution and so on. And that may be behind, for instance, a lot of brain degeneration with age. That the neurons can be whatever, 70 years old, but the mitochondria are constantly undergoing some population biology, and relatively older people are often quite degraded. So the mitochondrial genome, through this iterative selection and mutation and so on, may undergo a lot of evolution in what we would consider unreplicating cells. And then I'm going to discuss several proposals by which the chromosomal genome may be able to test and reverse alleles without fixing them. So the usual idea with cells and the usual idea with evolution is that you have to commit yourself to a new allele, to a new DNA sequence, before you can test it against the environment and find out if it's going to help you out or not. It's debatable how much, yeah. It's not known, okay? It's not known. There's some data and so on, but it appears within neurons in particular that most, although there's some new neurogenesis in adults. A lot of the neurons we have been there since, you know, we were born or before, or maybe less than two or three. So by the time one is 70 or 80, these cells are relatively old. The nuclear genome, relatively okay, hasn't replicated and so on. But the mitochondria, yes. Yes. May well be turning over all the time. There are little organelles inside, and they have little. Furthermore, there's like 50 per cell, maybe more, and, I mean, depending on cell, and maybe like 50 or so chromosomes in each one of them, right? So, yeah, a lot. In difference, the data isn't perfect, okay?
Turning over, you mean replicating?
Replicate and dying.
Replicating and dying.
Yeah, so you have.
It paints a population of 50 organelles.
Some of them are eliminated.
Yes, and I mean, over the many years.
What is the selection mechanism?
Right. Well, one of the selection, all of this is rather speculative, okay? Mitochondria are where ATP is made, where oxygen is made into water, and so on. And it can generate one idea is that this is a chemically dangerous process that 1% of the time makes reactive molecules, hydroxide radicals or peroxide, H2O2 or OH with an extra electron, things like that are chemically dangerous, and they're made on the mitochondria. So the furthermore, right, this is really hypothesis, right? But here's what I think. Okay, so these free radicals are formed on the membrane of the mitochondria, okay? Right next to the F1, F0 ATPase, right? Zork. They don't have a big range of diffusion, right? So they hit it. When they hit it, that damages the very molecule that's doing this ATP regeneration. That creates more free radicals. So what I think is that you have supernova of mitochondria. That is a feedback on a particular mitochondrion due to the generation of free radicals that blows it up. And so these little puffs blow up, and that then others replicate to take their place within the cell. Yeah. In yeast, Fangman has been able to do very nice pulse check. So the kind of experiment he did, Meselson-Stahl density shift, so you can see the replication and the timing of the replication and synchronize up, and then probe the density gradient with different things, right, to see if there's late replicating chromatin. And in that case, what he found, even when the nuclear DNA very synchronized and so on, he had mitochondrial replication throughout the cell cycle. In mammalian cells, that kind of experiment is relatively more difficult. You use BRDU label, and it's harder. It's harder. So I don't have an answer. I think that the general answer I've seen in literature is probably continuous, and certainly occurs continuously in neurons that are. I don't know. I mean, you get kind of a smear, what I've seen in such papers. So what proportion is going in? It goes back to another issue, which is if. These are kind of interesting issues related to this. We don't know if they're germ cells, the equivalent of germ cells for mitochondria. So let's say within a cell, it's dangerous. Let's say it's dangerous, like I said, to make ATP for the rest of the cell. Maybe there's a germline of mitochondrion, like one mitochondrion that itself is not doing oxidative phosphorylation, but is generating the others, like the idea of differentiated cells, right? And stem cells, a stem mitochondria. This is a discussion I had with Bruce Ames, but it's completely fair. And that even within a mitochondrion, we don't know, for instance, if all of the DNA replicates or if one goes into rolling circle and creates the other copy. And this goes in that the work that they do might be very dangerous. But it goes back to the whole issue of why, in evolutionary terms, why bother keeping a mitochondrion genome at all, which is like 0.001% of the genome of the endosymbiont that first made it, right? So they're really ununderstood games, if you want that kind of evolutionary game or molecular mechanism game. And one of the things we're trying to do, just kind of playing around, but we have ideas how to do it, is like to move all of the mitochondrial genes into the nucleus and see if we can get it to work. I don't know why they do it the way they do. And of course, an experimental approach rather than everyone's, okay, let's break it. Let's see what we can build.
How key is it that they only have something like 50 DNA? Because I thought that it was not entirely clear whether there should be a structure and that you
Right. That's right. Certainly in yeast, from reconstruction experiments, there may be, serial sections and so on. There's some people who argue, and this may depend on growth conditions, whether the mitochondria are syncytial, and thus do they break apart under some condition, and also, cytological issue, how separate are these compartments? So the whole issue of compartmentalization, much less, than if you have one thing with 2,500 chromosomes, are they competing with each other and so on, in the Lin Chao sense. So there's a lot of interesting stuff. However, that's not what I'm going
to
talk about yet.
Yes. Coming back to my physicist question. So yeah. I think of mitochondria not as one unit.
that's a population of 50 organelles or molecules.
Well, yes.
And some of them are more resistant to free radicals than others. But this resistance is somehow heritable. So
well,
that's a selection.
Well, one way to be resistant would be not to make any ATP, wouldn't it? Because then you're not channeling the oxygen. So, if you were a mitochondrion present in an aging brain,
right,
you might realize you could get away with murder.
Guys, right?
So you might get away from the free radicals and just kind of replicate and not do the work. Deleting part of your genome for the cytochrome oxidase would be a good way to do that. For instance, if that's the game they're playing, right? Definitely.
So
definitely.
In the game theory sense, then what's the mitochondrial gaming? Why do they want to do all this hard work?
I think these are really good questions, and they relate to the question of why does it bother keeping some DNA in there, right? I mean, you know, probably some danger to the Golgi to be secreting all the time, right? But they don't, in some informational sense, have a choice. So we can play these games with the mitochondria because they have a genome. They don't have much of a genome now. Remember, 99% or better of the mitochondrial proteins are encoded for by the nucleus, which are imported, right? So, but I would like to play this level of game with something else, which relates more to the experiments I want to discuss now. But the concepts are not unrelated, and that's that nuclear genes may go through the same kind of selection inside a single cell, and the way that I have in mind for them to do it is that DNA proceeds through a reversible intermediate, which is a non-Watson-Crick structure. That is, you don't have perfect base pairing, you don't have the symmetry. Enzymes can feel that it's not perfectly smooth. But that you can have phenotypes that are the result of this reversible intermediate and specific to the information contained in the reversible intermediate. And if this reversible intermediate becomes the subject of replication, then that information is kept in canonical Watson-Crick DNA as a new sequence. So that's the system that I want to explore now. And it was inspired by a great theoretician who's also experimentalist, Frank Stahl, in the context of this kind of thing of Barry Hall, when you were asking of how is it that under some circumstances the bacterial cell seems to have so-called directed mutation, seems to acquire particular mutations more when that does it some good. And we can critique definitely aspects of the experimental, of particular experiments, and indeed we can critique mine in relation to that. But this is the proposal, and it's beautifully stated and it's very clear. Should I read? Anybody? Everyone in the back can read? Fine. Yes. You can't? Okay, I'll read. Okay, my proposal is based on the post-Luria-Delbruck demonstration that mutation proceeds through a reversible intermediate. To a good approximation, we can say mutations result only when correction systems fail. And then a scenario, right? Imagine a lac-minus cell. This is a cell that can't make the enzyme beta-galactosidase, which allows it to use the substrate lac. Imagine lac-minus cells on lactose medium adventitiously replicate DNA segments provoked in time by nicks and gaps of their outrageous fortune. So you might say the cell is starving, it's chewing up its DNA, either in an induced, enzymatic, intelligent way, or it's just a result of dying because it's starving. Okay, in the lucky event that synthesized DNA segment is adaptively mutant. So what this is saying, you form gaps, but then there are repair enzymes that fill in the gaps. Many of those repair enzymes are pretty error-prone. I mean, whether you want to invoke higher error-prone or whatever, on the transcribed chain. If this new sequence on the transcribed chain is adaptively mutant, the resulting ability to utilize lactose stabilizes the mutation by allowing the cell to replicate. That is, each half of the heteroduplex then becomes a template. Now let the starving E. coli adjust relative rates of steps of mutation, replication, and mismatch correction, and away she goes. The point that I haven't emphasized here is that, in fact, cells have a way of telling in this heteroduplex which is the old segment and which is the new segment. So if it's not doing any good with some time constant, it'll go back to what it was. And
this this explains that that minus is just there's a few sort of fine mutations and so forth, the complete genes.
Right. In this case, we're dealing with point mutations.
Can you repeat that? I didn't get what measures the times there.
Okay, let me maybe deal with it in this abstract way, because I have the template. Actually, I redrew it here, yeah.
So this can happen without there being replication involved. It is, could you imagine the luck magnet sort of reverting the wild type without replicating, just by eventually, you know, like
Yeah, this gets into a lot of issues about full-blown replication, right? Kind of like in our society, have the phrase "full-blown AIDS," you know, versus repair synthesis. Versus, so yeah, you can change the DNA sequence. That's right. So looking at a cell, you don't realize that that cell is going through a lot of states of having a different DNA sequence. Because usually, from the Luria-Delbruck point of view, and this is something which is really buried, because in Luria-Delbruck analysis is very beautiful, but it expects mutation rate to be a function of the number of cell generations. That is, each time you replicate normally, you have certain probability of making an error. And certainly we've heard of this in population biology. It's a very common thinking, and it often works fine. Having said that, right, it doesn't apply everywhere. And this goes into the issue of molecular clock and all of this stuff. It's not, you know, and that's that from molecular point of view, yeah, you can change the DNA sequence, and from looking at the outside, you don't know that that individual has a different DNA sequence. And it's especially tricky when you have selection and the scoring phenomenon that you need depends on replication. So this becomes degenerates into semantics. If I take a phage culture and put it under a UV light, right, are there mutants in there, or are they only mutants when I plate them and select them? You know, because those who can grow outgrow now. So yeah. Okay. So here's the kind of yeah.
So what does it direct? Is it directed replication of the lac gene? How does the cell know to fix the lac?
Right. Here's the concept here. Okay. So we have random generation. So in that sense, it's very Darwinian. In that sense, we're saying the lesions are generated absolutely randomly, okay, throughout the genome, point mutation, precursors. Okay, radiation, gaps formed at random, oxidative damage, and so on. They make these intermediates we'll call G-star. These G-star intermediates correspond to non-canonical DNA sequences. So this could be a base mispair, right? These G-star structures, these non-Watson-Crick things, are recognized by a lot of repair enzymes and go back to what they were. Okay? On the other hand, so that's conservative, and you never know what happened. On the other hand, if they are transcribed or in some way create a phenotype that makes the repair less likely, then they make their probability of fixation into homoduplex more likely. Ditto, other kind of intermediates may make their repair more likely rather than less likely. And so I'm saying that these intermediates really have a phenotype, and that's a different way to look at evolutionary theory than one that says you have to fix a new allele in order for it to be subject to selection.
When you say it has a phenotype, just to clarify, what you mean is that it produces enzymes and proteins?
This is one mechanism by which you can have a phenotype, and this is the one Frank proposed. That that it's a template for transcription, and that the transcription will use the template in the same way that a subsequent round of replication would use that template.
Does the repair network rely on some underlying genes? And if so, is it possible to switch them off in some way and look at purely random mutations?
Within particular contexts. You know, certainly you can affect these processes by having mutants in the repair enzymes. This issue of complete randomness and so on, but some pathways of creating non-randomness and so on, yeah. I mean, they're good games to play. I just want to emphasize, though, the general feature now. Yeah.
But David, there's so far no direction at all. Now
picture that this mechanism, I'll give you an extreme example, and these are matters of numbers to play with. Let's say that you create new G-star alleles, and they have every 10 seconds, every microsecond, right? And it takes another microsecond to test them. This, of course, is not realistic, right? But if you create one at a time and test it in another microsecond, and if it doesn't help you in 2 microseconds, you bring it back to what it was, then throw a dart somewhere else on the DNA and do it. That, if you look outside the cell, would look damn adaptive, you know? In the same way that if you take a population, right, and select the one of bacteria in a population that's whatever, resistant to streptomycin, fine, you don't know what happened in the bottle, right? So it's bringing the black box inside the genome in that way and saying you don't have to replicate the cell. So from conceptual point of view, that's not very threatening, right? I'm just saying a random thing. And I haven't actually dealt with other implications actually come up, which I'll just mention, I'll get into a little bit later, which is if you let the time scale be a little bit longer, which of course it is for the testing and so on, then you'll have an integral for all of the intermediates in the cell, and you have the ability to evolve epistasis of a lot of genes inside the same cell in a very interesting way, along with the hitchhiking of other guys who are just around. Because, if you have 100 intermediates, all of which are affecting the constants in each direction, and that's the interesting game, I think, could be made into a good and beautiful theory. Yeah. But now, I'm sorry.
Just connected to this diagram. So if you generate the G-star, then how the repair mechanism then sees an almost great pattern at that locus. So it may decide to repair either strand.
Right.
So you could actually go into G prime or back into G.
Yes. It
seems to me that this is a sort of issue of the time scale. And if this G star is relatively short lived, respect to G or G prime, then you would probably expect any selection on that stage rather.
Yeah, let me say first of all that in the case of mismatches, what Frank was proposing originally, there is directionality. And that directionality was first studied in the case of replication, and it's that newly replicated DNA in E. coli is under-methylated. It's not methylated at GATC sequences. So there's methyl groups at the A's of GATC sequences, which occur as they should by chance, you normally call it. Newly replicated DNA is unmethylated for, say, 10 minutes or so. And so if the polymerase, so-called, makes a mistake, right, and sticks in a wrong one, there is, in fact, directionality that's conservative in that process. And I'll show some experiments later that this directionality functions in other contexts, too. In the case of other kinds of intermediates that other people suggested, there's also directionality of repair in the conservative direction. So the bias is toward the conservative. What? Fair enough. Conservative, is that a decent word? Informationally conservative is the bias. But of course, the enzymology can be putzed around. And in fact, when you were asking about genes, yes, there is a mutation one can make that destroys the asymmetry and conservative nature of information processing of mismatches, for instance. And in other cases, one could do that too.
So it's the ability to revert that's the key.
Well, it's the ability to revert is one aspect, and the other aspect is that the intermediate, the reversible intermediate, is something of consequence for the cell. And that goes to what he was talking about, phenotype, and it's within the cell, but it has a phenotype, and in the interaction of its phenotype with the external environment.
But I think the issue whether it's directed or anti-symmetric or non-symmetric is interesting in itself, but it doesn't matter, because even if it preferably goes back to G, then that could be just absorbed into a lower effect.
Yeah, I think that the point is that if this intermediate itself can, whatever the basal rates are, if the intermediate itself feeds into them and alters those rates, then the probability of fixation into a really a new allele that's just different DNA sequence will be affected by the nature of the intermediate. So that while that process is reversible, and for different cases, the intrinsic bias in spite of phenotype will be different. Is that fair? Respond. But all good stuff to build into models, and I need help to do it most beautifully.
So the G-score is like helicubic, it means that the gap is filled in by RNA?
Oh. Well, in this case, I just use G-star to mean an intermediate which is something that is not canonical Watson-Crick homoduplex, okay? Okay, so it has. So normally, when we talk about normal DNA, we say if you have an A on one, you have T on the other, so you have perfect complementarity. And if you go along the outside of the helix, it's very smooth. It doesn't matter the base pairs, it feels the same. And that's the way of most normal sequence. But in making a mutation, there are intermediates that are physically different. And those physical differences are usually, I think, not properly or as completely considered in evolutionary theory as I would like to consider them. Like that they have molecular uniqueness and that they could play into the directionality one to the other. So the in this case, one of the points I want to make is that I was going to talk about this later after the experiments, but this needn't be an all or none phenomenon. That is, if you have replication going on, but it speeds it up or slows it down, you have repair going on. So these, I think, could be quite quantitative effects, So I don't think it's limited to whether or not you're absolutely stopped. But the particular molecular proposals in this context, as I said, Frank really articulated it with DNA heteroduplex. John Cairns talked about it as error-prone making messenger RNA. Then you have reverse transcription and recombine. That was critiqued in many ways as being too ad hoc, from a molecular point of view. There wasn't evidence. But actually, this idea did inspire the discovery of reverse transcriptases in several bacteria, although it appears not to play in this mutation scenario. So it was a good idea in the sense of being fruitful. A couple of other people have suggested 0,6-methylguanine, which is an alkylation intermediate that causes mispairing and for which there is also repair that has directionality. And 8-oxyguanine, this ties to the mitochondrial issue, that it's one of the main mutagens created by the act of breathing. Although the absolute level of it is apparently in dispute. Bruce Ames has said many times we have whatever, 500,000 a day, from each nuclear genome. But it appears that may be off by a factor of 10,000, in fact, because when you isolate the DNA and make a single strand, there's a lot of chemistry of oxygen and our DNA that goes on, especially when the DNA is single-stranded, regardless of whether or not you're having mitochondria and making free radicals. So it's experimentally not clear how much. But at any rate, it certainly exists, and it's repairable intermediate. And these have miscodings. So 8-oxyguanine can pair with A. And so you replicate that. You get a T where you had the G and so on. And the same kind of thing that the 0,6-methylguanine can pair with T, and thus you get an A where the thing was. And so these all have the, you can imagine scenarios in which those point mutations. My own hit on this, right, is that ribonucleotides get into DNA once in a while. And in the case of ribonucleotides, we have enzymes called RNase H and other things that take them back out. But part of this reasoning then leads to the experiments I'll discuss now, where I wanted to ask if the ribonucleotides in DNA can be a template. So in effect, if you can have reverse transcription without reverse transcriptase. And then recombination intermediates are another kind of range, which I'll wave my arms at a little. Yes?
If you were to increase the error rate of repair mechanisms, like mutating the repair mechanisms, so would you trigger a heat shock response?
Heat shock response? Maybe in the sense that, some arguments is, the mechanism for inciting heat shock response, not clear, but some of them are that there may be a cellular sensor of misfolded protein. So maybe if you have more of misfolded protein, you might might sense it, you know, so I'm not sure. But I think that the mechanisms for sensing heat shock response are subtle enough and not understood enough. Well, apoptosis goes is very related to this because it's an interesting place to have the microphone. Because none of you on the internet know what happened. because if the phenotype is death of the individual, right? If you're sensing these death events, then of course it's going to bias whether or not one gets a selectable mutant. And in terms of relevance to cancer and so on, it's the P53 that senses apparently these kind of irregular structures with DNA and would push the DNA into the direction of death, which may be a mechanism in ourselves for preventing this. So what I'm saying in a way is that this mechanism is so good, right? It's almost like you have to fight against it, and P53 may be, in fact, a way of preventing this mechanism from operating in our cells, but in cancer, it may be unavoidable. It's something I want to know, but I don't. So here's an experimental design that's in that SPURT paper, short patch reverse transcription. And basically, we have an ochre mutation. It's a stop codon. We have it in the LAC-Z gene. We get blue plaques on a phage. We can turn them white. We can turn them blue. We have another a restriction site built in, so we can check, you know, exactly the sequences that we're changing and so on. And what we've created are oligonucleotides that have ribonucleotides covalently continuous with DNA. So that's the thing. I'm saying if we have positions of ribonucleotides that are the same backbone as the DNA, what happens then? And it turns out if the DNA polymerase gets a running start on normal DNA, it crosses over RNA. Many DNA polymerases, it turns out, do this. And are what? Pairs, yeah. Yeah, it does, in fact, because we try. What? What does it do? So you have, you know, when you replicate DNA, you use one chain as a template. Suppose that that template has DNA, but then it has some RNA. You know, all of a sudden the DNA changes to RNA. Then that RNA is used as a template for making a subsequent round of DNA. And that's reverse transcriptase. We know about that. But the point is the normal DNA polymerases, which are not reverse transcriptases, can do this kind of thing if they get a running start on a DNA backbone, at least for little patches, and that's...
So you're getting RNA incorporated, or you're getting the appropriate DNA opposite the RNA?
Oh, and the RNA is in the template, and what's made in this case is DNA. The phage, when they're done, are perfectly normal DNA sequence. Of the information content, which was temporarily present on RNA, it's just that the ribonucleotides are another example of a kind of reversible intermediate that are once in a while incorporated into the cellular DNA, and they're taken out. So they're just another kind of way that you have temporary genetic information in the DNA that could be a template for normal DNA afterwards. And here's some other backbones I've played with. Yeah? No, I didn't really discuss. There's several mechanisms. One is the concentration of ribonucleotides in the cell is 100,000 times, you know, what the DNA is, and, you know, polymerases aren't perfect. And depending on physiological conditions, it varies. In vitro, for instance, if you give manganese instead of magnesium, a polymerase is put in RNA, ribonucleotides quite easily. There are all kinds of things that can affect that frequency. They're there to a certain extent. Again, getting back to mitochondria just for kicks, is it was discovered by Vinogrand, who first discovered DNA supercoiling, that he could never get supercoiled DNA out of mitochondria when he used the normal prep, which is alkali lysis for that kind of thing, because it breaks the ribo part. So all of our mitochondrial DNA has all of the time, every chromosome has some ribos in it, right? I don't know what it means, right? But there they are. And other things do a little, depending on conditions.
Is the fidelity of replication the same?
Right. The data is in our paper. Here's the paper, that, and I have it here, where we gave. We were not, I mean, we didn't have a mutation. I mean, we hundreds, okay? It, as far as it went, over hundreds, we were not able to detect any unfaithful information transfer. So having ribose in DNA at the level of resolution we looked at, which would be like a percent, right? Something like that, we were not able to detect.
You want to use this as a source of a genetic.
What I want to say, yeah, what I want to say is that the insertion of a ribo may be a mistake, but it wouldn't necessarily be the base that's a mistake. So in this case, we're marking the backbone, not the base. So it's different from the other proposal in that what it is that makes this intermediate of a ribo reversible is not that the base is recognized as being a funny base, and not that you have a base-base mispair, but rather that the backbone is marked as something that you put in there by mistake and you're going to take it out.
So there's some error thing, error correction thing that looks for different.
That's correct. We have an enzyme called RNase-H, is what it's called, that particularly degrades the RNA moiety of the DNA-RNA hybrid. Yeah.
What do you mean by collaborate?
By what?
What do you mean by
collaborate? co-authors. Co-authors, in this case. Collaborators in a... we should describe other things besides this work we've done together. I'm not going to describe how it was used in Buffy yesterday, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And this was the other paper there that I discussed about other kind of backbones, right? You can think of this as a very slight footnote, right, on the DNA as the genetic material, and just saying, fine, you can put the odd methyl group, the odd phosphorus group, you can do a little chemistry to the backbone, it's still the genetic material. But, in fact, enzymes do recognize it and treat it differently, even though the base... Now, I haven't really, with this, the point is that although this is a step, this is not getting at this G-star kind of thing I was talking about in all the way. Because what I haven't shown, I've shown that these things can be a template for replication. I haven't shown that they're a template for transcription. And I haven't dealt with the very interesting mechanism, which is, can you have the same reversible intermediate that acts as a template for transcription and then rescues itself, kind of bootstraps in that way, and gets the same information in the subsequent round of replication that it itself facilitated, okay? So for that, this is now the work in progress and what I'm really involved wanting to do now. I have to tell you more about the life cycle of phage F1. Okay. This is about 5 kb. It's present inside the phage head as single-stranded DNA, as a single-stranded circle of DNA. And what's inside the phage head is the plus chain. The plus chain is known as the chain you publish. Okay. That is, the chain whose sequence, when you read it, corresponds through the genetic code to saying that that's the sequence of amino acids in the proteins that will be translated. Okay? When this thing goes into the cell, host functions are responsible for using the single chain that comes into the cell as a template and completing a double chain, making the complementary chain. Okay? Yes, but there is. There is, but it's ironed out enough that you make the double-stranded covalently closed circle through the host functions, the RNA polymerase and replicase. And it's then supercoiled, and the new chain that's made is then the template for transcription, which makes messenger RNA of the same sequence. Now, in one of the genes that's made through the transcription, it's called GP2, gene product 2 of the first one, is essential for further replication of this circle. It binds to a certain site, nicks, recruits host enzyme, and then the thing replicates further, okay? That's the life cycle. Then it's packaged and goes out. And system developed by a guy named Smith. He won Nobel Prize with it actually for his development of it, along with Carrie Mullis from PCR, who's so useful in biotechnology, is to use this single-stranded circle isolated from the phage heads as a template for in vitro synthesis by annealing an oligonucleotide to it and extending in vitro, making a double-stranded circle that's the equivalent of what's made in vivo. And the reason that it's so important in biology is if there's a particular protein encoding gene that's been cloned into the phage, then you can use it to create any amino acid variant you want and explore the biology. So tremendous amount of kind of structure, function, enzymology has been permitted by that kind of work. Okay. So the way that I've used it is a little bit different in that I've started now with a chain that's amber in gene 2. Okay. So the phage, when it infects a non-suppressing strain, is this okay, guys? Non-suppressing, amber mutation, and so on. You don't make any gene 2. There's a stop codon. And yes, go ahead.
No, I'm just asking.
Yeah, no, it's okay. Yeah, no, well, stop codon, I mean, it means, an amber codon means that there's a particular sequence of bases that does not encode any amino acid, and so it can't be translated. Hence, when this phage with an amber codon and this essential replication protein infects a cell, it's stuck here. Okay? Fine. There are other cells in which it can grow. Those other guys have cognate transfer RNAs that have an anticodon against the amber codon. So you can grow it, but in other cells it won't. Okay. In non-suppressing cells it won't. Okay, so we've taken that and annealed to it now oligonucleotides that have functional information. That is, they would make a good gene 2 protein onto the amber template. So we have this heteroduplex here. Yes. But now it's an amber in gene 2, over which the heteroduplex is. And the synthesis is finished in vitro, creating something equivalent to what happens in the cell when would enter. Except this time the template chain has information that encodes a functional gene 2 protein, whereas the plus chain has amber information. So, when this is transfected into the cell, the game is that the information on the oligonucleotide has to be used in order to make gene 2 protein, which then allows the replication and the rescue of that information in the subsequent round of DNA replication. So this is the game I was talking about, you know, or that originally Frank was talking about, and that one can use this reversible intermediate as a bootstrap in order to rescue information into DNA as a canonical double-stranded DNA with a new sequence. Just to credit someone else, Norton Zinder is really the guy who characterized this mutant and did a great deal of beautiful stuff with this phage altogether, but in particular, his work on replication and this particular amber allele and showing what a beautiful block in replication it is allowed this work. So the results that I'll say are that it essentially works. We can rescue about 10% the level of if we have DNA, if we have ribonucleotides in there. But DNA-DNA heteroduplex also works, and that of course works 10 times better, and that's closer to Frank's original proposal. And I would like to do experiments with 06 methylguanine and 8-oxyguanine and so on. But at any rate, the principle in the system does allow at least a demonstration that you can do this bootstrapping. And here I'll just show kind of an interesting sidelight of sequencing from the rescued phage. So these are different oligonucleotides. Actually, they're reversed, but the equivalent sequence to the plus chain. And the point is, when I've used some oligonucleotides, so you needn't rescue back to wild type. You can rescue to almost anything that isn't amber. So I've used some different sequences here. And the point is, in some cases, when I use the so-called wild-type sequence, there's... So in the amber, we have... this R86 is the sequence here. And then if we put the wild-type against it, we put a G here, and we always get the G in the sequence. That's the point. We've broken the amber, and we get back the same sequence that we put there in ribose. On the other hand, in the case where we put an A here, 2 out of 10 or so times I got back an A, the other times I got a G. So in some cases, there isn't faithful information transfer, something I didn't see in the other experiments. And I haven't... I mean, I'm not going to try to interpret it at the moment. It has interesting consequence, even if you have some, and this is more stuff for the evolutionary grist for the mill. If having some information gives you different information in the messenger RNA, and yet you still rescue the allele through another error-prone mechanism, so it's kind of like focusing error at a particular place. Not exactly DNA, not exactly precise information transfer. So again, the relationship of selection and stochastic processes is very neat. So this I mentioned here, depending on the case, information transfer is not perfect, but it is relatively focused. The other caveat, I mean, I've built these molecules. I know what they are. I know how they behave and so on, but you know, fair enough. I mean, they're different games. One can play. One way that I want to play this in relation to cancer and all of that is to actually measure the number of heteroduplexes, right? Usually people look and say, how many mutants do I have, or what's the difference in the whole DNA sequence? I want to know how many intermediates you have. But I argue, of course, that not only is it plausible, it's sort of unavoidable in the right circumstances. Like in a case where you don't have the P53, which a lot of cancers don't, so they're not going to die. So cells, I would say, in some sense, the cells of our body go out of their way to avoid this kind of circumstance. So going back to the theory, this is where P53 would act, right? That death is certainly a phenotype. Whether or not it's an interesting phenotype depends on your perspective, but the point is the P53 pathway supposedly senses this level of reversible intermediates, this level of damage, and results in death if it's too much or otherwise stops replication until they're repaired. So modulates all of these pathways, right? The direction of all these pathways. And as I said, this is on a cellular level, it's directed. And from my point of view, one of the most interesting things is that it's not all or none. Even though Frank described it as all or none, to a first approximation, these experiments with the gene 2 are all or none. In fact, when you think about it, anything that changes the relative rates of these will result in a bias in the fixation of mutations that is superimposed on any bias that may exist in the creation of reversible intermediates, and that really most mutations do go through these kind of reversible intermediates. And that was when I first did it in a 5-minute outline that somebody said, so will this result in hitchhiking? And it'll result in hitchhiking, say if you have 100 intermediates in the cell and one saves them all and results in replicating, that's hitchhiking. On the other hand, the point is instant epistasis, right? Because what's really going to affect replication is the integral of all of these things that are present in the cell at any one moment. Because we're saying that the cell doesn't have an interesting way to say, I really like the G-star intermediate at 2 minutes, but I really don't like the one at 10 minutes, right? So that's where it plays into the time scale of how long is each one existing and you know, the repair rate and the rate of testing and what mechanism senses them and which pathway does it send them down and so on. Let's see, cis-acting, freeloaders, co-mutagenesis, Okay, so I guess this is a good place for a break. This is just some other stuff I wanted to wave my arms at that we have in the papers. This one, because it's work with Marcello, it's an actual physicist, bona fide physicist. And the first paragraph, I think, is just, it's a very nice kind of polemic statement. Living beings possess molecular mechanisms that can change in a heritable way both the rate and kinds of genetic variation that they generate through mutation and recombination. In this letter, we consider some aspects of what happens to mathematical formulations of evolutionary theory when this type of genetic alteration is included in the formalism. Because these mechanisms do not encode traits in the usual sense, but actually implement the generation of diversity, any model of evolution which takes them into account has some degree of self-reference and this results in qualitative changes in the behavior of such models. I'm not going to defend or... that's what's in the science one, the evolution of genetic intelligence, yes, definitely. I mean, certainly we can get, I mean, you could yell at me if you want. I mean, you know what I mean? This is, I'd say we're winning in the sense that from molecular point of view, we're correct. But the interface of it with real, with the population genetics and evolutionary theory is not done. I mean, it's not done. None of us understands life. It's serious work. I just wanted to show this, not to think. There's Fokker-Planck equations. There's Cramer's time. Jumping barriers becomes linear. We have these papers. I think Marcello was here. You can deal with it. I just want to show it's bona fide within the vocabulary you guys deal with, and you know, and yet it follows very much in the references, and you know, it's very bona fide biology as well.
There were some claims by the group in Tel Aviv of Eshel Ben Yaakov that the
problem with Eshel, right, in my opinion, right, as microbiologist, is that some of their microbiology is very flawed. So I'm not in a position. Well, I mean, as far as the theory of the fit of, you know, how would you make one pattern or another, it's fine. But from technical point of view, their microbiology was flawed. And what I mean precisely is that some of the cultures, which they said were changing patterns in a heritable way, were actually mixed cultures. So on one medium, one would grow, and it has a different colony morphology. On the other, another would grow. And this was straightened out by Rivka Rudner. And there's a paper in Molecular Microbiology that really deals with that. So, I mean, many people have, what can I say, some beautiful idea, some nonsense. And in this case, I mean, Eshel, my understanding, is very, you know, theoretical physicist, right? What are you guys? Theoretical physicist, right? Who did not form collaborations with honest microbiologists soon enough.
Which Eshel
Ben Yaakov? That's my opinion. And so that they, I mean, it's easy to be fooled in life, experimentally in anything. And it's not the end of the world to make a mistake. But anyway, so the particular, and I, you know, how this works into an individual's career, into an individual's psychology. And I mean, these are real, I mean, we flat out don't understand life, right? So it's a lot of work. And people have gone insane studying, you know, far, far less mysterious things. So that's probably much more in some way than I should say over the internet, but I'll say just check Rivka's papers and you know, consider critically the relationship of experiment and theory in all of these cases. Here's another case where this is about recombination, homologous recombination, but the point is that the level of homologous recombination and the sequence stringency, that is the distinction between self and not self on the level of sequence similarity, is itself under genetic control. And so a lot of the species barrier, if you define species barrier as being how different or similar your DNA sequences have to be in order to recombine, that difference is under genetic control and is modulatable in a continuous way. And I can just mention some experiments. Just these numbers here, we have 10,000 fold.
You have a way of formulating an understatement. You mean essentially that organisms can decide at the molecular level whether they are accepting to mate or not after the actual...
Oh, yes. The fact that sequence similarity matters says that the decision is made after heteroduplex is formed. Yes. Oh, it's not in focus?
So you have to behave nicely with your mate even after the actual incoming?
Well, it goes back to this issue of mutational intermediates. See, one of the things that I'm saying is that in sex, as in mutation, that we have in effect G-star intermediates. That is, the state of the reaction when it's partial you know, is rate. I mean, it's always a question when you consider, if you consider this kind of a chemical reaction, the generation, you know, the parents are the substrates and the new genotype is the product, let's say, in a chemical sense. There's always a question of what's rate limiting for the reaction, you know, which sub-reactions and so on. And so the fact that we find such 10,000-fold effects, say, based on enzymes that recognize mismatches in the heteroduplex, argues strongly that a rate-limiting step in this reaction occurs after you've formed the heteroduplex. Certainly there are other cases where you have rate-limiting steps somewhere else, and of course you can have many rate-limiting steps. Anyway, so it's 10,000-fold effect in conjugation in this system. It's recombination between E. coli and Salmonella. Within protein encoding sequences, they are 80 to 90% similar. So in the wild type case, you have a mismatch once every 10 or once every 20 bases, and that gives a very low level of recombination. But if you do the same cross in a mutant that's deficient in methyl-directed mismatch correction, the amount of recombination goes up 10,000-fold in that experiment.
What are the phenotypic consequences?
The phenotypic consequences depend on the experimental system. I mean, we're selecting for prototrophs, for ability to grow on minimal media, and for the ability to use certain sugars. I mean, but...
How do you recombine the two chromosomes?
Oh, right. Again, this word recombination being used in different ways. So, from one... point of view, experimentally, what we do is we put together a male and female bacteria, and we let them conjugate, we let them move the DNA from one to the other, and then we ask whether that DNA becomes homologously integrated into the recipient. Why would they do that? Okay. Let me try it on the board. Okay, so within cells, we have a DNA double helix. Okay, and then you have some new DNA that comes into the cell. And this new DNA shares sequence similarity with one of these. So then there are proteins, largely RecA is the most interesting of them, that coat single-stranded DNA, and in an enzymatic way helps that DNA find its complement in double-stranded DNA. Okay, so once you form this kind of, let's say you pair with one chain, the other chain is now wronged in some sense, then you have to ask, what do you do to go from this to go to something where and this of course will have heteroduplex, right? We'll have mismatches and so on. But you want to get something where this now becomes covalently continuous with the host or with the other chromosome, where you've created a covalently continuous stretch of DNA that has a new combination of alleles. And that could happen through breaking and joining, you know, the phosphodiester bonds, or it could happen in principle through template switching and replication.
My question earlier, Father, you have to physically introduce the DNA.
Yeah, that's right.
The two cells by themselves, they're not going to want to...
Right. The relation of information and material transfer is always a good question to ask in biology. I agree.
Do you do this in some selective way? Or
yes.
So you select.
So these experiments were done by, and I have that paper here. So you have a recipient, which in this case was a Salmonella, which is almost like E. coli in the sense that it has the same genes in the same order around the chromosome, but they're different by 10 or 20%, presumably through, you know, some kind of drift. Because they presumably haven't had sex in a couple of 100 million years, right? And the reason they haven't had sex, or one reason they haven't had sex, is that there are enzymes in there which recognize heteroduplexes that have mismatches in them that are not perfect and abort that reaction, prevent the recombination from going all the way. Thus you've amplified the effect of sequence divergence on isolation. So that amount of sequence divergence that allows reproductive isolation is itself genetically controlled. And it's also physiologically controlled through a bunch of different interesting mechanisms. Yeah. And This is another kind of experimental system in which I'm selecting for histidine, okay? So I start with a salmonella that cannot make its own histidine. It needs to have histidine given to it if it's going to grow, okay? I give it histidine DNA, or DNA that encodes a wild-type allele for histidine biosynthesis made with E. coli sequences that differ by one or so every 10 bases. And in a mismatch correction minus mutant, that is a mutant that cannot recognize non-Watson-Crick base pairs in heteroduplex, it's a few hundred times better at incorporating that E. coli information than it is in a wild-type salmonella background. And the control is, if I use salmonella, that is identical DNA sequence, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Going back to the first question, this, you intentionally, as an experimenter, inject this foreign DNA in a salmonella. It's not that a rec minus salmonella would sort of be...
Oh, a rec. Well, I mean, you need rec A protein for this to go. And what's been known for a long time, I mean, that salmonella and E. coli can easily conjugate plasmids, autonomously replicating plasmids. So you don't have to do something very fancy to let them have sex with each other to move DNA by themselves. So this is not a transfection system. In that sense, it's less artificial than what I'm doing with the F1 phage. In this case, I'm putting a male conjugate of E. coli in the presence of the salmonella, or I'm growing transducing phage on the E. coli or on the salmonella and letting them infect the other guy. And for plasmids in the wild type, it's fine. You know, they've been doing that for hundreds of millions of years too. Sharing plasmids is okay. But they haven't had homologous recombination that depends on the pairing in that long, probably. Or at least that's the sequence analysis indicates that. So in this case, moving the DNA is something, you know, they do pretty well by themselves.
Because it was thrown off by your previous remark of put on a long orbit probably, because you said that the decision whether recombination is or not is done after the
I mean,
it's not a record. The question is whether the salmonella E. coli don't conjugate because they have surface recognition.
Oh.
Issues that don't work out.
Sure.
Or whether they do conjugate, but then it never comes to recombination because of this hitter.
Right. There are a lot of different barriers. And all I say is that in a particular circumstance, I make this one a factor of 10,000. Indeed, you can get lots of bacteria that have some kind of surface exclusion, including strains of Salmonella and E. coli that have a hard time transferring replicating plasmids. So in this particular system, which is not an unusual one in nature, actually, the transferring the DNA is not the problem. It's the survival of the DNA after the transfer. And indeed, in another context, the prevalence of restriction modification systems in bacteria lets you know that transferring DNA happens quite frequently, and that regulating its recombination after it's in the cell is a frequently important mechanism or level. Oh, we made mutants in mismatch correction genes. These are the genes which were first discovered to be involved in post-replication recognition of non-Watson-Crick heteroduplexes. Right. It's arguing that the same kind of reversible intermediate, that occurs in replication or occurs in that experiment, for you know, where you build a non-Watson-Crick, a mismatch heteroduplex, or when you think of the DNA polymerase making a mistake and sticking the wrong base in normal replication, that same kind of heteroduplex or a very analogous structure occurs as an intermediate in homologous recombination. And the idea is if you have 9 out of 10 bases in common, fine, there's a lot of Rec A in vitro and so on will pair those things pretty well. But in vivo, it really knocks recombination down. On the other hand, there are levels at which Rec A can also play those games, I think. But this is now stuff that will be, what can I say, work of the future with, Roy Zviv in Albert Liebscheber's group and those guys. I think somebody came here and talked about Rec-A recombination. And so there are systems we're talking about where, in fact, Rec-A might regulate the sequence stringency. But these are fantasies at the moment, not experiments. All right, so now I say, since the stringency, the difference between two sequences that recombine is, at least in some systems, limited after formation of the heteroduplex, because how else can you tell that two things are divergent other than matching them? And this goes back to your question. It's very radical to say they could tell from the cells even, you know, if they hadn't mated. But not only that, even if the DNA is in the same cell, how in the world are they supposed to tell if the sequence is different other than pairing and detecting? Brooks Lowe is a nice, really good guy who years ago, he was actually a physics PhD, for whatever it's worth, before he became bacterial geneticist, but not the kind of hybrid you might want. But at any rate, he showed that one could transcribe recombination intermediates before you form the final, you know. So these kind of intermediates I've shown are candidates for something that could actually make a wild-type enzyme that, in fact, in the same way I've shown with these kind of replication intermediates, could presumably influence whether the reaction is aborted or conservative informationally, or goes on to make a recombinant genotype.
But you said before that the restriction evidence phase is only by chop off foreign DNA, so you don't need necessarily comparison of heteroduplex. It's just enough that they contain...
Right. No. These are quite different, but they exist as mechanisms for isolation. And it's this issue of defining self and not self. So, in the case of the restriction enzyme, you don't need to share any sequence whatsoever with the DNA that's coming in, other than, you know, the occasional restriction site. But in this case, I'm using what I would argue is a more fundamental definition of self. In a living thing, self is my DNA sequence, right? And if some other creature is close enough to it, I'll become one with you. You know what I mean? I'll make hybrids. I'll, you know, share. But defined by the difference in linear sequence, I will declare myself not willing to recombine, not willing to make novelty. And so I think that's a very interesting level at which to define self, at which to restrict recombination. And so it's very interesting that that level is under genetic control.
So you're saying that there are two levels. One is...
Oh, there are many more, like you said, like surface isolation, sure.
Right, but once the DNA is inside, you say there is restriction attack if there are the restriction sites, but if that passes into that level, and
yeah.
There's still a control of the
heteroduplex. Yeah. I think that this kind of heteroduplex level control probably exists in all cells. Because, and REC-A, you know, the enzyme primarily responsible for forming the heteroduplex, is very universal. I mean, cells without it are sick or dead. And on one level, when you have DNA sequence in your cell, what's going to prevent REC-A from coding it, you know, and searching for similarity? And REC-A is rather promiscuous in most cases, in the kind of similarity that it'll pair with. So like many biological processes, you have an editing or a further function of regulation, you know, and you get more fidelity by having iterative levels of checking and editing. So you could look at it as an editing or a proofreading mechanism on recombination.
If it can be done briefly, how do you detect transcription of G star?
In Brooks' case, in the recombination case, well, I described it in the case of the gene 2, the system I'm working on where it bootstraps to replication. In Brooks' case, it was done with LAC-Z. So he takes two bacteria that have different alleles of beta-galactosidase. And beta-galactosidase, there are a lot of colorimetric substrates, so you can measure enzyme level. And so he would mix the cultures together, and from a certain number of bacteria, a certain number of matings, get in the culture a level of beta-galactosidase, and then plate from that culture for recombinant LAC-plus cells who had formed a new allele by recombination between the two, by homologous recombination between the two. And in some genetic backgrounds, he got a very high level of production of beta-galactosidase, but a very low level of production of LAC-plus cells at the end. And in other cases, in other genotypes, the level of beta-galactosidase corresponded well to the number of LAC-plus cells. That's his experiment. Yeah. Yes?
rather scholastic question. Surely nobody checked that. But if you have a piece of DNA which changed in place during recombination.
Change what?
You make a recombination, and a piece of DNA, two pieces of DNA exchanged.
Okay.
Now, is there any difference whether these pieces are absolutely identical or different? You have just one point change there.
Yeah.
Would it make a selection, recombine those which do have a change, and less so which do not? Because I could imagine that it could recombine identical pieces not knowing about that. Did anybody measure the percentage of useless recombination acts?
It's difficult in a couple of ways, depending on the system. I mean, one thing I'm saying is if the heteroduplex contains mismatch, you know, there's kind of Schrodinger effect, right, or a kind of uncertainty effect, that the marker effect. I mean, one way Miro put this is, it's called, in genetics, it's called a marker effect, when the gene you're studying affects the process you're studying. And the way Miro put this is, speciation is the ultimate marker effect, you know, which is... the other way that it has a lot of consequence, of course, for our chromosomes and all of them, is that the recombination itself, especially if you're doing crossing over the junctional place, might be at a place of perfect similarity, of perfect complementarity of sequences, but you might have other regions that border it that are very different. So certainly there are cases when the recombination itself is not going to be subject to any kind of editing based on sequence similarity. But those two similar sites will border something that's very different. And that has consequences for the product, sure. But in that case, you're not forming it, the heteroduplex stuff I said doesn't apply. Yeah.
Question. Maybe I wanted also to get an answer. Can you measure homologous?
Absolutely identical? Yeah, you need, here's a system, let's say, where you can do that. You need to play different games. But here's one that was developed by Henry Huang that I think is very beautiful. And I have the strains, but I haven't really played with it much. But he has also a very beautiful paper showing the effect of mismatch correction using this system. Okay. So here's the pieces. It's a lambda phage into which is cloned a piece of human immunoglobulin. Okay. And you can infect this lambda phage into cells that have a PBR-type plasmid, which have other regions of human immunoglobulin genes. So these are your cassettes that differ, and you know the sequence of all of these. And there's also AMP resistance on here. So experimentally what's done is to infect an E. coli cell that harbors the plasmid with the phage and get out the phage burst, and then you can measure the proportion of phage who've incorporated the plasmid by homologous recombination. In this case, crossing over will incorporate the plasmid into the phage. So the proportion of the phage yield that's incorporated the plasmid, and which can then be measured by density gradient centrifugation or by plating and titering the number of AMP-resistant transducing particles, is a measure of the amount of recombination. And you can do the experiment by, you know, having cassettes that vary, you know, the sequence of all of them, or perfectly similar cassettes. And so that's a good way to, it's the best system I know to address these questions. And they certainly reach the same conclusion about the effect of mismatch and so on. And there's a lot of good ways to do it. And of course, the AMP resistance is another case, what I was talking about. You have the recombination in perfectly similar sequence, but you're incorporating, by virtue even of perfectly homologous recombination, a sequence that has nothing to do with any of the sequences.
So in other words, you may well have absolutely identical genomes around, and they would still recombine just in case.
Yeah, there's a couple of other things going on. And this, remember the fellow who... Alex, right, was saying he had, you know, his most famous or funny paper with this sex and you. Right? So I have a paper that is kind of related to that, and it's called Sex is for Sisters. And in this case, what it's saying is that recombination between the sister chromatids, who after all should be identical in DNA sequence actually does have a lot of genetic consequences and actually pre-adapts the enzymatic and evolutionary machinery for sex with others. Oh, when the two when a chromosome replicates, the two daughters.
Before they.
The two. Well, we from the mother's point of view, from the original heteroduplex, they are daughters, right? But once they're formed, they're sisters, or the two daughters of the same mother. The daughter strands become sisters. I mean, yeah. Or right, in meiosis, each of the chromosomes that pairs, you know, we have each of them has, you have premeiotic DNA replication, so you have sisters there. And so sister chromatid exchange and generation of diversity through recombination. I mean, the way I define recombination, right, is yet another way. And see, how do I call it? I say, I like the last paragraph of this one. In summary, sex is for sisters defines sex as the generation of variation via the interaction of similarity. DNA regions which share the requisite length and similarity, parameters which are themselves under genetic control. Oh, sex in the single genome occurs between DNA regions which share the requisite length and similarity, parameters which themselves are under genetic control. So even in the same thing, in this mismatch correction, you got plenty of intra-chromosomal recombination. And the other thing is, a lot of recombination mechanisms involve forming gaps and double-strand, single-strand gap repair, and that stuff can be done under some circumstances by much more error-prone enzymes. So even if you have perfectly homologous recombination, it can be a way to target point mutation, so variation that didn't exist in either's. Anyway, I say biology will always be a source for social metaphor, especially the biology of sexuality and its origins. Sex is for sisters emphasizes an evolutionary metaphor in which sexuality is primarily a mechanism for maintaining identity and enabling creative differentiation within self. Sister sex pre-adapts and maintains molecular tools for collaborating with others and creating further diversity. Right. So, yeah. Want to stop? No? Yes?
So you were saying there's a lot of recombination going on within the same gene?
Well, there are two kinds now. Yes. Well, let's put it this way. Rec A cells are sick or dead. Okay? I mean, they're really sick. I mean, if you take a Rec A minus E. coli, about half the cells you look at under a microscope won't form a colony at any moment. Right? And probably a lot of that is that the replication fork. At least the current thinking is, when the cell is replicating, it drops a stitch at the replication fork a lot, and it, you know, maybe like half the cells anyway, such that they need sister recombination in order to survive.
But that is between sister strands.
That's so correct.
You could imagine a rec A transporting, picking up some part of the strand of one genome and. Having
yeah.
a position on some homologous other.
That's true. I mean, certainly intra-chromosomal recombination. So if you have hetero alleles. Anyway, if you have hetero alleles on the same chromosome, you can certainly measure their recombination. And if you have portable cassettes of homology, you can form a lot. Like, for instance, duplications in wild-type E. coli or Salmonella. Form very frequently. If you want to look, like E. coli normally haploid, but if you look in a culture, about 1% of the cells are diploid for any gene you want to look at. You know? So they have formed duplications through intrachromosomal recombination of various regions of the chromosome, and they're very easily reversible, too, because they have, you know, large regions of homology. So. What?
Different
parts of the
same chromosome. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, they're different reactions. Why do you need two chromosomes? Not when you have a sister. Of course, you have a sister as an unavoidable consequence of replicating. Okay, and all of it is similar. Okay, but a lot of sequences in a normal bacteria are not present in multiple copies and cannot undergo homologous recombination, but some of them can. You know, so. So, well, I mean, some genes are present in duplicate or near duplicate within, you know, that is degenerate repeated sequences and so on, in normal bacteria, different places around the chromosome. But by no means is every sequence in every bacteria present there twice. I mean, one of the most interesting cases for that might be when you look at the ribosomal RNA genes, usually have 7 or 8 copies, and you can look at similarity and differences between them and get some sense of that there. And they tend to be the same. So you tend to say that they have homogenotized. And that, in a certain sense, is a measure of the recombination at that level. But there may be selection. I mean, it's not clear to me that if you were making ribosomes with different subunits and so on, that you'd necessarily want them to diverge. I don't know. I mean, this is an interesting question because the ribosomal stuff is used in so many evolutionary considerations. And because the theory was around for so long that you might differentiate ribosomes to handle one or another kind of message. There's no evidence for that. They seem to be pretty general purpose. Okay. So I'll just, there are other cases I can discuss that involve moving huge. I have another horizontal transfer case that's not going by homologous recombination, but that's rather moving large chunks of the chromosome between species of bacteria. And I'll just show it this way. This is a pulse field gel. Show this one. This is, these are Enterococcus. They're a particular bacteria. They actually, so it's kind of a clinical case. So this is a recipient. This is one species of bacteria. Okay? This is its chromosome on a pulse field gel, and it makes these 4 bands. Okay? This is, the other lanes are transconjugants with another species of bacteria. So look first at the first lane. This band is gone. And it appears to have moved up here. Okay? So you've added a couple of 100 kb of DNA between, in this interspecies recombination. But what's most interesting to me in this case is here's another transconjugant with the same group of recipients that's moved like another 100 kb. I mean, the same band has moved further up. And all of these are stable after they're formed, but it's just showing, you know, with huge amounts of DNA, different amounts of DNA moved in each conjugation event. And they're all stable after they're made. And this is just the phenotypic characterization of a bunch of these. So these are potential things that the bacteria can eat, potential carbon sources, right? This is the donor for the conjugation events, and this is the pattern of carbon that it can eat. This is the recipient. It's another species of bacteria, and it has a different pattern of carbon utilization. And the interesting point is that each transconjugant of the dozen tested here has a unique pattern, which is different than both the donor and recipient, different from every other one. They're all stable once they're formed. It tests them weeks, months apart, just like the pulse field gels. They're not mutators in that sense. But it's each interspecies recombination has created a new, a really new creature. This was just with clinical strains. I mean, this is not very engineered in that sense. So it's a very natural process. And you can ask, of course, why are they called different species and all of that. And this is associated with the conjugation of an antibiotic, vancomycin resistance. So it's as if a piece of selfish DNA that encodes the vancomycin resistance has, in a sense, gone altruistic, taking hundreds of kb of the chromosome with it. Well, I mean, it's the DNA, like a transposon, is spreading itself around. But I'm saying it's so the selfish DNA has now dragged along 10% of the chromosome of the donor for no particular reason that I can see, although it has consequence for everybody. That's all, yeah. That's what I meant. Like the genes that encode the vancomycin resistance and the transposon stuff is like 5 kb, 7 kb, right? But it's taking hundreds with it. What else was I going to mention? I don't know whether anybody wants to get into immunology, but I could mention some things about immunology. All right. So the part about immunology that I'm interested in is what I call natural antibodies. So these are the in our germline, there are a bunch of cassettes. not complete genes encoding antibodies, but pieces. And our antibody repertoire is made from the combinatorial joining of these germline segments that then create in our somatic tissue the genes that encode the antibodies. Okay? Now, while the combinatoric cassettes in our germline are many, they're not infinite. And the set of antibodies that we make by joining the unmutated germline cassettes is part of what we call natural antibodies. That is our repertoire before we have encountered anything that skews it one way or the other in terms of somatic selection. And there's some evidence, some of it ours, that all humans are born with a stereotype set of natural antibodies, not even every possible germline cassette. Okay. And what this does, nobody knows, but the ideas are maybe we were evolved to be ready for certain pathogens, so it's nice to be born with antibodies that recognize them. Maybe you'd like to cover all of shape space with low affinity antibodies so that then you have substrates for somatic mutation and enrichment. Because after all, the way that that whole theory works is you say you have to have somebody of low affinity that then you begin with. Then there's this beautiful idea of the immune network. Does everyone know of this immune network in Yerna? And this beautiful, beautiful paper, The Generative Grammar of the Immune System, which is one of the most profound and deep papers I know of. And so here's his insight. Is he says, look, it's about the sense of self from an immunological point of view. So we're made of a certain number of proteins encoded by genes. On the other hand, we have, through the generation of antibodies, the ability to make lots of new proteins. So let's say we're infected with a virus or bacteria, and you evolve an antibody that binds to it very well. The shape which binds to this this antigen, this virus, let's say, is one of your antibodies, but it now is a unique shape in your body. So being a new and unique shape, that will also be recognized by the immune system, and an antibody will bind to that. It's a complement of that shape. And in fact, this whole network, right, then that's a new shape and so on. So he argues, I think, very beautifully and convincingly that the immunological sense of self is as profound, as deep, and molecularly complex as is the neurobiological sense of self.
You know? How much evidence is up front that there is less evidence about the scientific networks?
Well, yes, I ask every immunologist and so on to discuss this. And what everyone tells me is there's evidence that, you know, they exist on the second and third level that they're found. But in terms of explaining how the immune system works, people have run out of good experiments to do. So they believe that they're true, but cytokines or other methods of regulating the immune system have come to the fore. And in that sense, it's not so fruitful. But let me put it this way. Here's something I'm working on trying. I mean, but it's a very, I think, deep and beautiful question in relation to that, which is, if I give you a mill of my blood, can you tell me the shapes to which the antibodies in it will bind? And you can't. I mean, there's no way to. So when we talk about genomics and so on, and phenomics and proteomics, what I want to make is immunophenomics. That is to get to be able to say what is the repertoire of shapes. So I'll tell you a little of our attempt, like to get it. So here's one kind of attempt. This is not my work. It's this guy El Muthon and PNAS and so on. What they did here is they ground up things like liver. Okay, so. You make a one-dimensional gel of proteins, complex mixture of proteins spread out in some way. Then, spread over that gel is the serum from the umbilical cord of a newborn. 16, in fact, newborn babies. And then it's stained with anti-IgM antibodies. By the way, IgM antibodies, molecular weight about 1 million, are not transferred from the mother. They don't cross the barrier, the fetal placental barrier between the mother and the fetus. Unlike Ig class G, for which there's a special transport and so on. So these are really encoded by the fetal genome. Anyway, there's 16 different ones on different complex mixtures of protein, and the point is you have this stereotype pattern. So that's one attempt to get like a repertoire, a sense of what is the vocabulary of shapes. But the thing is, you don't know if they're binding to the same epitope on different ones. You don't know the sequence and so on. So it has its limitations. And then in this work, we pushed it a little further by taking two antibodies encoded by the two different neonates, right? And then we used a technique called phage display, where you can give an antibody a billion different random peptides. So, fine. You have a billion different peptides in 10 microliters. You say, fine, antibody, just tell us what you like. Because, of course, it's very different. Like when you immunize someone, right, you have a sense, fine, we know what the antigen is that we should have stimulated. But it's a different question when you take the blood of a newborn, right, and say, here's an antibody in it. What is the epitope recognized by that antibody? Right? It's not obvious how you catch it. And so by giving a random, and this goes also into the issue of how big is shape space, what does a billion do, is it rigid enough, and lots of good stuff to understand there. Okay.
So aren't there, isn't the possibility to synthesize, so to speak, some virus kind of shape, which in fact would not be recognized by any of the antibodies, so to speak, to map the boundaries of this space which can be generated?
Yeah, I wonder. I have ideas how to do it experimentally and theoretically and so on, but I'm not clear how big shape space is. I mean, what's bound by an antibody, the kind of size range we're looking at, is, 30 angstroms on a side, 50 maybe. How many different shapes can fit in that, right? How many, carbon atoms, there's 2.7 angstroms between them, you don't have so many. So this is a kind of interesting physics game, right? How big do you expect the shape repertoire to be? But of course, on top of it, one of the interesting things is, what's the shape of my hand, right? And this goes back to the thing we were talking about in terms of genetic diversity generation. So there are a lot of shapes it can have, but not all shapes, right? And of course, the entropy thing and how much time is it spending in each one and how does that translate into binding energy and all of that. And there are many cases also where different, that's how opium works, right? So opium is something which is chemically very different than peptides, but we make endorphins and Keflin, so they're amino acid sequence that in 3D shape bind to the same receptor as the opium. So it's not obvious to me that if you make a peptide sequence that the system hasn't seen before, will that overlap with shapes it doesn't have? What is shape space made of non-peptides? I mean, these are deep and beautiful issues.
In fact, this is we used the group by Yaron Cohen, which has similar views about this. As a support to this cognitive aspect of the system, the point being that, in fact, at the level of antigen-antibody, there is no one-to-one correspondence. In the same sense,
right,
in which I do not recognize your hand just looking at it or just holding it, but only having
Here's, in this case, we have two different antibodies that have different sequences. They recognize the same peptide sequence, okay? So the antibodies are different, and yet they recognize the same shape. In this case, there's another interesting thing, just a trivial point here, but an interesting one, which is we're all born with antibodies encoded by these genes, at least, which bind to the heads of human sperm. So we don't know what they do, but, normally that epitope occurs there. Yeah.
I wonder how important is the folding correlation? Suppose you have two different antibodies which recognizes reasonable strengths of given antibodies.
Yeah.
And one of those antibodies also recognizes something else. What are the chances that the other antibody also will recognize this other antigen?
Oh.
That will tell you something about the dimension of the space of different shapes.
Right,
the same
right.
Correlation is present and measurable.
Right. We cite some of those references in this paper. The point is now, there are cases of both. Okay, plenty of cases of both. Is it different portions of the binding pocket is one thing, or how much do they overlap? And you also have cases of the opposite, which is antibodies that are incredibly similar, which recognize very different substrates, right? Which do not cross-react and so on.
The only way out of it is to have a large enough table of who recognizes whom.
That's right. And we're working on ways to play that game.
Do you have a table?
No, but I'm working on experimental ways to create such a table. Yeah, I agree.
What about the natural table of protein-protein interactions in the cell, say field table?
Well, I don't think it's going to be as beautiful or as complete. I mean, in principle, I think the set of antibodies and the set of shapes recognized by antibodies is the way to play the game. But,
is there anti-selection going on? Do you want this antibody to... It's fine, it binds to that, but you don't want it to bind to other...
Right. I mean, in terms of the natural antibodies, of course, we think that we've been selected to encode some optimal repertoire of antibodies at birth, and that's why, you know, the hint that it's uniform.
Right. So you develop, this new thing coming, you develop it, well, bind to that. But how do you make sure it doesn't bind to...
Right, I agree. I mean, there's issues of selection, and of course, the generation of diversity in the case of antibodies and all these somatic products are really, you know, cases where there's a lot of focusing on how the diversity is generated, and you know, how focusing mutation just on certain regions and the combinatoric of the cassettes. I mean, and of course, you have organismal selection at some level. Okay,
but
just
this is part of the basis of the clonal selection.
Sure, the somatic selection, but we have to play with the germline too, and do the same things exist in the germline? I mean, there are many. Let's discuss it later. I mean, it opens up a complete world. I don't have a short answer. I just wanted to show one other thing related to the pink noise and blue noise, what I discussed before. This is bacteriophage lambda again. And this is a method which allows you to see the distribution of homologous recombination along the length of the chromosome. Okay? So, in the wild-type case, actually you'd look at this peak plus this peak. So the distribution of recombinants is pretty even across the 50 kb of the chromosome. This is a mutant which differs by one base pair that creates a hot spot for homologous recombination. And it just shows that instead of this distribution being maybe more recombination here, but that's only because in physical distance the marker is about three quarters or two thirds of the way, I guess, across. So that the dark circles are recombinants that occurred between A and C, and the light circles between C and R. So the result in the wild type case is that we're looking at more or less an even distribution of amount of recombination per base pair. On the other hand, in this mutant, which differs by only one base pair, you can see a huge shift of recombination. But it's not digital. I mean, it's what you would call pink noise, right? But it's just one base pair. And there's certainly other mutations and other ways that one can shift the generation of diversity. This particular mutation is called Chi. It's an 8 base pair sequence, which, although I did my PhD close to it, I can't remember. Yeah. This is a mutation in lambda. However, a mutation in E. coli, which neutralizes the RecD gene, gives you the same pattern of recombination. So yeah, you can get this pattern of recombination through either a mutation of one base pair in the phage or a mutation that creates a null in a particular recombination gene of the E. coli, which also alters completely the spectrum of generation of diversity. Well, in the case of Chi, it's a site, an 8 base pair site, which can occur anywhere and stimulates recombination in its vicinity. It's a recognition site for an enzyme. The enzyme for which it's a recognition site is a tripartite enzyme that is encoded by three subunits, which are the products of the RecB, RecC, and RecD genes. And the null mutant in RecD has the phenotype of Chi-activated RecBCD. Is a phenocopy of chi-activated RecBCD. So the effect, which is rather like what happens, I'm not going to get into so much the mechanism, because let's just say the enzyme is changed. The wild-type enzyme is changed when it encounters the chi sequence, and so you can have a phenocopy by already having the activated form of the enzyme. So this is just a list. This is a pun. It starts out in a pun because Jacob had a very important paper in 1975 called Evolution as Tinker. And it's about the way that in evolution many many things are used for a purpose other than which they were first evolved. So it's about pre-adaptation. And it's a very beautiful essay. And so this is kind of a pun. It's called Tinkerer, because one of the things that it emphasizes is slippage at iterated sequences. So I put a typo in. No, I was, if only I were so smart. Anyway, these are about existing mechanisms that are known through which the generation of diversity is evolved, focused, has some stochastic element, but not. And that's was in this one for which we have. I can make copies or PDF files, but it's the list of these mechanisms with references that I think are grist for evolving. Okay.
I should remind you of the T-shirt in Harry's office.